I'm going to turn the microphone on. And please just feel free to come forward. This is a safe place.
I find it kind of interesting that the theme throughout today has been one of refuge. I'm paraphrasing, but I believe the tenet goes, so as you do to the least of mine, so do you do to me. And with that in mind, a little story. This past Thursday, as Julia tried mightily to whip us into some sort of shape so we'd be ready to sing today, and at a pausing point in the prayer, in the song that we were rehearsing, we heard a noise off to what is now my right. And there, quite unexpectedly, stood a man, clean cut, but obviously a little down on his luck, and evidently homeless and wandering. He was what would now, in the day of my dad and my grandfather, would probably be known as a hobo, going from place to place and job to job, that being the differentiation between a hobo and a bum. A hobo works. And his request was quite simple. All he wanted was our permission to sleep on the bench, on the stoop, so that he might be out of the weather, just in case things changed. A couple of the deacons put their heads together and came forward with a not unexpected answer, of course. And as we broke the rehearsal, and he started to settle in, some members of the choir went into the vestry, fixed him a light, simple snack, and gave him something to drink that he might have sustenance as well as rest. It's a pleasure to me to see a group of people who not only talk the talk, but walk the walk in their everyday life. And pride may be a sin, but I am proud to be a member of this congregation. Thank you.
I'm going to follow because I have a similar story that sort of connects. Years ago, I took my children. We have two sons. They were quite young at the time. My husband was away, and I took them to visit their grandparents on the train down in Paoli, Pennsylvania. So we managed to catch an earlier train, and my in-laws weren't there to meet us when we arrived in Paoli. I got off the train by myself with my two sons. It was after dark, and there, lying on a bench, that train depot arrives down below, and then you go up the stairs right to the outside, and inside was a man lying on a bench. I thought, okay, this is a little scary. And I took my children, and we went upstairs, and there really weren't a lot of people around. There wasn't anybody around. Is this still? Anyway, the man followed us upstairs. Now I was really concerned, and I did the mother hen thing as he came towards me, and he said, "Do you have any money?" And I'm not a particularly outspoken religious person, but at that moment I just said, "I don't have any money for you, but I will pray for you." And it completely diffused the situation. It was just, and that's why I believe that God was working at that moment, because that man, I can't tell you exactly what he said to me, but it was paraphrased as something like, "Your children are God's. They're not yours. They're God's." And he left us alone. And I shared that story with my sister, and she said, "He blessed you back."
Thinking about, is this on? Yeah. Okay. Oh, there we go. So I was kind of thinking
Adele,
about
Adele, can I just suggest, because there's a lot of feedback going on.
Okay.
If you put it in the holder and are not quite as close, it might not feed back as much. Let's try that.
Is that okay? Okay. So I was kind of thinking about when I've experienced God.
I think
life.
You just turned it off.
Oh, dear.
There should be a little switch.
How about now? Is that good? Okay. So I've been thinking about when I've experienced God in my life and kind of thinking about, I don't have any real mountaintop moments or any kind of lightning bolt revelations, but I think being here in this church, in this sanctuary, kind of this community, the light through the windows, when I sit here in a service and just look at that quiet glow, that's a time that I really feel God and presence, and kind of our collective voices coming together is also when I feel God. At the Christmas Eve service, when the candles are all lit, that too is when I see him and feel him most strongly. I have had moments where I have wanted to find him and hear him, and that in one of the hymns that we were singing earlier, there was that my God, why have you forsaken me? And I have moments when I want to say, where are you? I don't see you. You don't have answers ready. And here especially, I've learned to kind of live in comfort with the lack of an answer, and to see that glow as the answer, and to see kind of that quiet being together in suspense and hope and wonder. So that's where I feel God here.
Excuse me, I'm going to put my earpiece on. I want to relate two stories. One happened to Ginny. Well, she caused it to happen, where she was traveling about town and saw a car full of what looked like a family of refugees, well-dressed children, mother and a father, and she walked over to the car on just an impulse to say, and knocked on the window, or I don't know whether you knocked on the window, but the window came down, and said, you know, you have beautiful children, and with all the hate that we hear about in the world today, I want you to know I'm glad you're our neighbor. And then last week, as almost as if it were a two bookends that were meant to happen, I was putting gas in our car, and I'm fairly mobile these days, but I sort of have to hop around the car without, I was using my ATV three-wheeler, and I couldn't pull that out at the same time, so I just hopped around the side of the car and started putting gas in, and this woman comes over, I could see her from the car near me, and she was obviously a refugee from Somalia or Ethiopia, who knew where exactly, I didn't ask, and said, "Can we help you?" And I assured her that I'm already there putting gas in, all I have to do is hop back, and either way I have to hop back. But I thanked her profusely for her offer. And it's little acts like these both received and given, that one step at a time we change the world and we change the dialogue that happens. And it too frequently is not that way. And it's a blessed experience when we step out of our comfort zone and receive and give.
I am not a member of your congregation. My daughter-in-law, Rachel Stein, is. And I was given the opportunity to take some pictures yesterday while a bunch of girls and one boy cooked at Virginia's house, and then went to feed people at the Salvation Army. And I just wanted to say it was really wonderful to see, and I have some wonderful pictures for you. But it's interesting to me, none of my grandchildren are my religion. They're all different. I have other grandchildren also who are Roman Catholic. But they're all brought up in such a wonderful way, giving, and generous, mm-hmm. and moral in this crazy world. Thank
you. Okay. This is a story about forgiving 70 times 7. I've thought about that. 70 times 7 is a hell of a lot of times to forgive. So I wondered where that came from. I've concluded that the first 69 times 7 must have to do with breaking down the barrier of righteous anger, grudges, holding. So maybe we have to do that so many times because it takes so long for us to get to the place where we truly are open to the other person. So when I was 8 years old, my mother sent me for piano lessons. It was in Grand Rapids, Michigan. She put me on the stocking bus, went downtown, took the elevator to the third floor of Fox's jewelry store, where my teacher had her studio. It was very dark in the hallway, and it was a very dark door, and on the door, taking the entire door, it said, Albina R. Kowalkowski. So I took piano for many years with Albina R. Kowalkowski. She was a rather taciturn person, rarely spoke unless necessary. She scared me quite a lot. She didn't say much when I played, but I did progress steadily through books 1, 2, 3, and 4, etc. Every year there was a recital. You had to play, you had to memorize your piece. And the recital was held in a very imposing formal hall with two grand pianos on a platform. And at least this many people, probably more, seemed like a huge crowd as a child. And so we would go up and play. And every year, some little girl would forget. And in the middle of her piece, she would freeze. She would get up and in her little crinoline nice dress, run down the aisle crying. And fortunately, that never happened to me, but it made an impression. Well, when I was about 14, I had a particularly difficult lesson. I used to cry when there was a terrible silence, and she never raised her voice, but I was extremely aware when she wasn't pleased with me. And when I cried, I was already wearing glasses then. I couldn't see the music very well. She never handed me a tissue. And it was quite a struggle. I was quite a shy person then, if you can believe it. And I went home and I told my mother, normally I was a very obedient child, I said, I am never going back to that woman again. So I quit. I didn't take piano lessons for years until I got into college, and when I did, I was absolutely astonished when my teacher told me I was musical. Wow. So time passed, I went to music school, and I became a private voice and piano teacher, very similar to Albina R. Kowalkowski. I said to myself, okay, my studio is not going to be anything like hers. I'm going to be friendly. My kids do not have to play at recitals, although I make them prepare. I make them memorize their pieces, but they don't have to leave their music. They can take the music with them, and in fact, if they're nervous, I'll sit right next to them, and I did. So I taught for many years. I had a wonderful, wonderful studio. And as years went by and my students grew up, I would get feedback. You know, I'd hear from them, and one became a concert pianist, although that wasn't my goal for them. But, you know, they almost always said, I still play, and thank you very much. And, you know, it just warmed my heart. Well, at some point, many years into my teaching, I had another transfer student come in, and as usual, they had terrible fingering, horrible technique, they couldn't sight read, and I thought, oh, here we go again, you know, I'm going to have to put them back a year or two, and we're going to start from scratch and make sure they know what they're doing. But suddenly, it occurred to me that everything I did in my teaching practice was totally modeled on Albina R. Kowalkowski. I taught kids how to play scales. I made them learn theory and harmony. I found out many other teachers didn't do this. I introduced them to all the great composers, as well as popular music. Albina R. Kowalkowski made me learn how to play hymns and vary the accompaniment. When was I going to use that? I was living out east since I was 17, well, 20, and rarely went back to Grand Rapids, Michigan, where I grew up. I started to wonder, who was Albina R. Kowalkowski? I had no idea who she was. I didn't know her family. I didn't know anything about her. So I thought, I was overwhelmed with feeling of gratitude for this woman and what she had done for me. So I found her number, and I called it, and a family member answered and said, I'm sorry, but recently she passed away. So I never had a chance to say thank you, and I'm so sorry. You know, there are people in our lives who are difficult, and I have my share, I'm sure you do too. And in fact, I probably am on the list of other people who find me difficult. But what I hope I've learned is that when people rub me the wrong way or behave in ways that are not comfortable for me, that they're a whole person. They're three-dimensional. And to translate love a little more freely when it is given, because clearly, Albina R. Kowalkowski really loved me.
So thank you, everyone. It is one of my favorite phrases is that everyone is my teacher.